The following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners is from the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm John Feddersen, welcoming you to another edition of Indie Week, The Independent. And today's edition, dated May the 5th of 2023. And by popular request, actually, we will be utilizing once again some guest musicians for a few weeks for our exciting theme music. And this is to give Claude and Maud, our faithful regulars, some well-deserved time off. Today's group are popular guests, actually. They're down from our nation's capital. You may notice a more full sound. There are 37 musicians in this ensemble, and they are, of course, a recreational group down from the Office of Fluctuation Control and Ceiling Repair, Bureau of Condiments, Soluble, Insoluble, and Indigestible Fats and Glutinous Derivatives up there in Washington, D.C. Now, the week of May the 5th, 2023, marks the 40th anniversary of this paper, journal, whatever you want to call it. 40 years and more than 2,000 issues after it began. And most of the print words in here outside of reviews and music articles are reminiscence from the publishers, editors, and a few of the writers that still remain on staff. I will skip those until the end. I've found some hard news, both in the paper and in the Indie Week online, indieweek.com. And I'll do all of the news-related articles, and then we'll hit what we can of the reminiscences and the arts columns. I may have more time for that today. Well, Wake Jasmine Gallup from Raleigh brings us about a protest from Raleigh women and doctors speaking out against this new proposed 12-week abortion ban. A year ago, when North Carolinians found out this U.S. Supreme Court was going to overturn Roe v. Wade, hundreds of protesters gathered in downtown Raleigh, devastated, confused, and angry. Today, there's just angry. "We're out here because we're pissed off," shouted one activist into the mic. "We're tired. We hate that we have to be out here in the middle of the day advocating for something that seems like it's a no-brainer. That's okay, because we're here, right? And we're going to make sure people know what we care about, right?" The speaker was rallying a crowd of about 100 who gathered in front of the North Carolina Legislative Building on Wednesday to protest a 12-week abortion ban, which was rushed through by Republican lawmakers Tuesday night. At the time of this story's publication, which was 2 days ago, Senate Bill 20 had been approved by the North Carolina House in a vote along party lines. It's expected to be approved by the Senate on Thursday, that's when I'm recording this article, and land on the Governor Cooper's desk soon afterwards. He's pledged to veto the bill, but that doesn't mean much in the face of a Republican supermajority. Republicans worked behind closed doors to reach a compromise that would ensure every member in the House and Senate would vote yes, with some pushing for an even stricter 6-week abortion ban. At the protest today, activists asked voters to call, email, and write their representatives in the hopes of swaying just one Republican and preventing this ban from becoming law. At the moment, pro-choice advocacy groups are still fighting, but they're also preparing for the worst. One of the biggest concerns is simply keeping abortion clinics in North Carolina open. Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, which runs 6 of the state's 14 clinics, doesn't currently have a center that meets the bill's, quote, political and medically unnecessary requirements, CEO and President Jenny Black said Wednesday during the rally. The pro-choice organization is working to meet those requirements, which include additional reporting, inspection, and licensing mandates, but the high cost of making such changes could put other clinics out of business. If new abortion restrictions become law, clinics will also continue to struggle to provide the care pregnant people need. The bill prevents most surgical abortions after 12 weeks and most medication abortions after 10 weeks, according to Molly Rivera, a spokesman for Planned Parenthood. So from the time you become pregnant, the clock is ticking. Commercial pregnancy tests typically give accurate results after about 2 weeks, when a pregnant person may have already missed their period. After that, a pregnant person may have to wait 2 to 3 weeks for an appointment at a clinic. There, according to the bill, they are required to give in-person consent, then wait an additional 3 days before receiving care. Rivera says, so there are 3 trips to the clinic, at least 72 hours apart, which will be a huge barrier to people. The bill has some exceptions. Survivors of rape or incest are allowed to seek abortions up to 20 weeks, and there are no limits on abortions for people who are at risk of death. But many experts say these exceptions don't work. Tara Romano, executive director of Pro-Choice NC, says, we've already seen the effects of the 20-week ban. There are doctors who work with patients with complicated pregnancies and medical emergencies, and they've not been able to provide the care patients need. So when you see a general 12-week ban, you're going to see impacts on people being able to access care. Any ban on abortion creates a chilling effect on medical care, says Romano. Patients may be confused about their rights and delay seeking an abortion, while physicians may be hesitant to perform medically necessary abortions because they're unsure of the law or their own liability. Chelsea Daniels, a family medicine physician who works part-time at Planned Parenthood, said, if doctors feel they are at risk in performing their duties and patients are too afraid to seek care because of the political climate, then patients are going to die. It's as simple as that. The maternal mortality rate has already gone up in states where bans have been enacted. It's an inevitability in North Carolina or any state that enacts an abortion ban. Daniels was not the only medical professional at the rally. Several students training to be physician's assistants also showed up, complete with white coats. Lila Letola, one of the students, said, I moved from Washington State, a state that really supports women's rights, so for me it's really disappointing, and it's scary. As a woman of reproductive age to live in a state like this, it makes me not really feel safe, not want to continue living here. Letola, like Daniels, works and studies at one of the Triangle's busiest medical facilities. But, also like Daniels, she asked that her place of study not be named, since many large hospitals and medical schools in the area don't want to enter the political fray over abortion. Unfortunately, it's these powerful institutions that could have the most influence in the fight, especially if they came out against North Carolina's proposed ban. After news about the bill spread, Daniels said she started having conversations with other medical professionals to explore how they might unite in protest. Meanwhile, Letola and her fellow students are currently in the middle of their reproductive health unit, where they're discussing patient-centered care, medical options, and North Carolina's laws. Another one of the students who asked to be identified only by the initials CZ is considering specializing in reproductive endocrinology, saying, we talk about ectopic pregnancies. We talk about how the mother can be in danger. Feeling like our hands are tied, like our decisions are being made for us, it just doesn't feel right. Their reaction to news about this ban was visceral. And Letola's reaction, like that of many women across the state, was angry. I was fuming, she said. It's personal. There's not legislation out there to control men's bodies and their reproductive rights. That's why I take it so personally. And that's why I get so heated about it. Next, Jasmine Gallup pens this, in a sense, book review, an interview, about a book called Lessons from North Carolina. North Carolina's turn away from a liberal or even moderate agenda in 2012, when Republicans captured all 3 branches of government, may be a done deal at this point, but it's worth looking back at how we got here. North Carolinians will find many of the events described in Jean Nichols' new book, Lessons from North Carolina, Race, Religion, Tribe, and the Future of America, horrifyingly familiar. Anyone living in the state during the 2010s will remember Republicans' unprecedented attacks on voting rights during Barack Obama's tenure, the battle over House Bill 2, and the GOP's crippling cuts to the state's unemployment compensation program. Nickel, a UNC Chapel Hill law professor, places these events in a unique context, arguing that they foreshadowed the decline of democratic principles we are seeing in the United States today. He also highlights lesser-known legislation revealing a worrying pattern of injustice perpetuated by the state's Republican Party. North Carolina's turn away from a liberal or even moderate agenda in 2012 is done deal at this point. It's worth looking back at how we got here. More important, it's worth looking at the way we now see the deceptive might over right politics of North Carolina's Republican Party play out on the national stage. It's tempting to think that North Carolina isn't the worst offender, with the kind of anti-LGBTQ and outright racist legislation promoted by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis. It's easy to point the finger at states like Florida or Texas, where a federal judge is trying to ban medication abortion nationwide. But in 2010, as now, North Carolina was home to a bullish Republican Party that made a national pastime of trampling rights to stay in power, not only through partisan and racial gerrymandering, but through restrictive voting laws, partisan judicial decisions, and undue influence over public universities, namely UNC. As Nickel puts it, "I'm not certain most North Carolinians recognize their democracy is seriously imperiled. Most are reluctant to conclude that an array of their leaders is out to end the American political experiment." He argues that the misleading rhetoric of North Carolina's Republican establishment, the likes of House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Leader Phil Berger, is just as dangerous, if not more so, than the outright insurrection of Donald Trump and his supporters. North Carolina Republicans may hide behind claims of voter fraud or states' rights, but ultimately, they're working for their own supremacy above others, in a kind of identity politics not often associated with the Republican Party. And he writes, "Many of our leaders are placing tribe over democracy and power over constitutive principle, saying some of us are full members, the real tribe, the full Americans, the owners, while others may be allowed to enter or remain, but are viewed more like tenants." He points to an array of examples, jumping from one legislative misstep to the next, to demonstrate how the Republican Party is testing the unwritten rules of democracy, as well as the concept of truth, in ways that are widespread today. Nickel's narrative can feel a bit scattered at times, but he cuts through the murky, confusing world of North Carolina politics with incisive observations about the real effect of Republican policies over the last decade. He takes aim at Republicans and some of their most ardent supporters, radical Christian evangelists, by speaking in their voice, exposing their true motives as well as the hypocrisy inherent in rubbing shoulders with white supremacists and those protesting abortions while paying for them. The most interesting chapter is undoubtedly the one in which Nickel gives his firsthand account of how the Republican-dominated legislature interfered and continues to interfere with the UNC system, likely permanently crippling what was once known as the best public university in the country. This 20-page Destroying a Priceless Gem chapter sheds new light on widely reported events at UNC, giving readers an inside look at the closure of Nickel's Center on Poverty Work and Opportunity, attacks on UNC Press, and decisions on Nickel Hannah-Jones's tenure. Republicans aren't the only object of critique in Nickel's book, however. The law professor also criticizes Democrats, calling them out on their unwillingness to speak candidly about Republicans' attacks on LGBTQ people, black residents, and other minority communities. He notes, "There is a notable chasm between Democratic politics and movement politics. While much of North Carolina, me included, believes the very meaning and character of the Commonwealth is urgently imperiled, its legislative representatives, the minority party included, often don't seem to act as if that is the case. Democrats wonder why people in their districts aren't turning out to support them, all while taking moderate, defensive positions, worrying about giving offense, and holding fast to the phrase, Republicans will be worse, as if that's an inspiring call to action, Nickel argues. His poignant example of the support that flooded in for Michigan Democratic lawmaker Mallory McMorrow following a blunt speech she gave about fighting hate in 2022 demonstrates that people will respond to courageous truth-telling. It's hard not to wonder how the Democratic Party has not yet learned that lesson. Still, Nichols does leave us with some hope for America's future, namely through stories of grassroots activists. His recollection of the Moral Monday protest, led by figures such as the Reverend William Barber II and lifelong civil rights activist Rosanelle Eaton, shows the power of collective action by ordinary citizens. Or underrepresented people could have a truly powerful effect in creating change if they focused on their commonalities instead of their differences, Nickel writes. Together we must be the guarantors, not just the heirs, of freedom. And he concludes, we can't claim only liberty's gift without also assuming its obligation. We've come to understand, even if reluctantly, that democracy is never a final achievement. It's a call to an unending struggle. Most crucially, we utterly refuse to give up on the notion of an America for all, even when it hangs frighteningly in the balance, especially when it hangs frighteningly in the balance. Next, from IndieWeek.com, is a reprint of an article, not a reprint, actually, it was issued in April 24th. I did not read it at that time. Abortion foes vow to keep attacking the abortion pill. North Carolina remains both a safe haven and on the target list. Though the Supreme Court has temporarily blocked an effective ban on medication abortion, anti-abortion groups are not giving up on trying to fast-track a national abortion ban, and that means continuing to try to quash nationwide access to the most common form of abortion post-Roe by whatever means necessary. Now, Reverend Patrick Mahoney, Chief Strategic Officer for the Stanton Public Policy Center, the lobbying arm of a powerful Idaho-based network of crisis pregnancy centers, which has heavily influenced Idaho's attorney general, said, obviously the pro-life community is disappointed that there wasn't an outright decision made concerning banning chemical abortions. But either way, for the pro-life movement and Stanton Public Policy Center, this does not deter us. We have many, many avenues out there to try to ban chemical abortion. Legally, challenging the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's two-decades-old approval of the drug mifepristone, despite its high safety and efficacy record in the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA, has been just one of the anti-abortion movement's many strategies to further curb abortion access. As this case continues to wind its way through the courts, activists are testing other regulatory and legal avenues. Just this week, this is a couple of weeks ago, anti-abortion activists once again petitioned the FDA to revoke the approval of mifepristone, but this time on environmental grounds. The national anti-abortion group Students for Life of America is arguing that trace amounts of the hormone blocker mifepristone could be posing a risk to endangered or threatened species and is trying to compel the FDA to study these impacts if the agency is forced to restart the approval of mifepristone as a result of the Alliance case. The group has also floated state model legislation adding environmental restrictions to medication abortion, which has been introduced in West Virginia. But this is part of SFLA's years-long campaign to curtail access to the abortion pill. They also oppose contraception and fertility treatments. And its board co-chair is the Federalist Society co-chairman Leonard Leo. SFLA President Kristen Hawkins said in February, "When I launched Students for Life more than 16 years ago, we knew we were going to need a trained army, ground troops, ready to go in states and communities around the country. The moment Roe v. Wade was reversed, and we began looking at this issue of chemical abortion 5 years ago." Anti-abortion legal activists are also currently leaning hard on the Victorian-era Anti-Vice Comstock Act, which plaintiffs in the Alliance lawsuit argue legally prevents abortion pills from being sent in the mail, something the federal government disputes. Meanwhile, the Alliance case is far from over. Earlier this month, the U.S. District Judge Matthew Kaczmarek of Texas ruled to suspend the FDA's approval of the abortion pill. That order never went into effect. Neither did the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision to keep medication abortion on the market, but to revive out-of-date restrictions lifted after 2016. Public health and legal experts have been warning that letting either decision stand would have severe public health and legal implications beyond abortion. And though abortion rights advocates around the country count today's decision as a victory, groups like the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists say the case has already caused damage. ACOG President Dr. Ifath Habasi Hoskins and ACOG CEO Dr. Maureen Phipps said in a statement, "Although the Supreme Court has kept mifepristone available to patients for the duration of this battle, much of the process remains in place, the damage. And we know that the attacks on abortion care will not stop, no matter how many times medical professionals declare that abortion is essential, evidence-based health care, and that interference in the patient-physician relationship must stop. We will continue to lead the medical community in providing the clear, strong evidence about mifepristone so that the Supreme Court can make the right decision in the end. ACOG remains steadfastly in opposition to interference in the patient-physician relationship." And meanwhile, the uncertainty and confusion over abortion rights in the U.S. marches forward, as are multiple lawsuits related to expanding medication abortion access. A recent order in the federal case out of Washington protects medication abortion in 17 states, plus the District of Columbia. More states are trying to expand as abortion haven states. Oregon just joined Massachusetts, Maryland, and Washington in their efforts to begin stockpiling mifepristone. The governors of California and New York have announced plans to begin stockpiling misoprostol, the second drug in the FDA's two-step regimen for abortion and miscarriage care. Providers in states not part of this Washington lawsuit have proposed pivoting to misoprostol-only protocols if mifepristone becomes unavailable. The method is said to be less effective and more painful. Many legal experts have argued that were it not for a biased judge, this lawsuit would likely have already been dismissed for failing to meet certain legal standards, and its legal and medical arguments have been widely disputed. Kaczmarek has been open about his anti-abortion and anti-contraceptive views, but has recently come under fire for failing to disclose his part in a law review article and radio interviews where he spouted off his anti-abortion and anti-LGBTQ ideology. In his ruling, the judge adopted the same rhetoric as the anti-abortion political movement, using terms like unborn human to describe embryos and abortionists to describe health care providers. If plaintiffs in the case ultimately prevail, public health and regulatory experts worry about the public health and regulatory fallout. During a press call earlier this week organized by abortion rights groups, Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, vice dean and professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and a former principal deputy commissioner of the FDA, said suspending or changing the medication abortion protocol to before 2016 is not based on scientific evidence, and sets a dangerous precedent of separating the science from the reasons to regulate drugs. And he said, these are the kinds of unfortunate questions you have to consider when you rip apart the evidence in public health from the legal framework, because they are designed to go together. And you pull them apart and you're left with all these truly unique questions, because this is so unprecedented. Like, what's the state medical board to do? What's the state health department to do? What's the FDA to do under these circumstances? We rely on an alignment between evidence and the law. When that's broken, it's, you know, it becomes a completely different scenario. Access to abortion has already significantly diminished since Roe v. Wade was overturned, with people having to travel and endure extended waits. But providers are determined to continue providing care to as many people as possible. Florida, with a challenged 15-week ban, that a newly signed 6-week ban won't go into effect before the 15-week ban challenge is resolved, and North Carolina, a state with 20-week abortion ban, and I've just read an article about that one, are critical access points in the Southeast. In the 6 months after Dobbs, Florida saw the largest increase in clinician-provided abortions, followed by Illinois, North Carolina, Colorado, and Michigan, according to a recent report released by the Society of Family Planning. Overall, there were more than 30,000 fewer abortions in the 6 months post-Dobbs, though that figure does not include any self-managed abortions. The increased threats to medication abortion have created heightened fear of criminalization and uncertainty among patients and providers. Abortion rights attorneys who provide free legal services and advice to abortion providers and patients as part of a newly formed abortion defense network have told State's newsroom that many patients have become scared to seek medical care needed related to their pregnancies. In the face of abortion provider shortages, travel barriers, and highly restrictive state laws, more people have begun to rely on this two-drug medication abortion of mifepristone and misoprostol. According to Guttmacher Institute, that's a research organization for abortion rights, 10 states would be especially impacted if access to medication is suspended, such as Maine, where the share of counties with an abortion provider would drop from 88% to as low as 19%. A Woman's Choice provides abortions at clinics in Jacksonville, Florida, and three cities in North Carolina, along with taking out-of-state patients from Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, according to Amber Gavin, Vice President of Advocacy and Operations. The organization's leadership is looking at the possibility of providing misoprostol-only abortions if mifepristone access is restricted. But she noted that the fight to preserve access to abortion is far from over, regardless of the end result of this lawsuit. And Gavin said, the goal of anti-abortion protesters has been to completely eliminate access to abortion care across the entire United States. They'll keep coming and finding ways to control our lives, families, and our futures. Now, I mentioned that this is the 40th anniversary issue of Indy, and there is an interview here with Richard Meeker, who is the current owner, who lives in Oregon. And it's a question and answer, but as there are some other cultural-based articles to read, I will excerpt this for the salient points. Mr. Meeker now lives in Portland, Oregon, and he talks about how he had bought it from Steve Shule, who, as a matter of fact, was the mayor of Durham for quite a while. And it was an alt-weekly model. Let's see. And finally, the last paragraphs are the most pertinent, I think, because there's going to be a new arrangement with Indy and Indy Week. And Mr. Meeker says he's a 70-year-old white owner of a Raleigh-based independent doesn't make much sense. And they'd better have local people who live in the area to control and help run and provide leadership for the editorial and reporting staff, etc. What can you tell me, asks the interviewer, about the new arrangement with the Assembly? Kyle Villeman, he answers, and his team will be overseeing the Indy, so there will be a local operator. Jane Porter will remain the editor. John Hurld will remain the publisher. The goal is that over time, the Assembly will acquire Indy. I've been looking for years, since well before the pandemic, to find a good, sound local operator for Indy. I think the idea that a 74-year-old white guy in Portland owns the Indy is nuts. During my many decades in this business, it has become increasingly apparent that local, independent journalism is essential. And if you want to have effective local independent journalism, there need to be local independent operators. Operators who are deeply committed to producing journalism that helps their readers navigate this increasingly complex world while at the same time holding powerful institutions and figures to account. That may seem obvious, but it's not all that easy to achieve. Over the 2 years that Kyle has run the Assembly, he has grown it to become an exceedingly valuable source of long-form journalism. It's based on a different model, all digital, and behind a paywall. I expect the Assembly and Indy to complement each other in ways that will be good for the Triangle and for North Carolina. Note that all digital. We know that print expense and paper and distribution are real drains as long as the same quality journalism can be achieved electronically. And that looks like it may be at some time coming down the road. The independent paper has been shrinking. Even in a few years that I've been reading this. All right, I will conclude that a short excerpt, but it's all available on IndyWeek.com. Now, because of the 40th anniversary articles, which mostly they talk about themselves as a publication, I have fewer hard news and opinion articles to be delivered, and so I can sort of indulge ourselves in the food and the arts for this week's broadcast. And the first comes from Bon's Cuisine on 9th Street in Durham, and it's in a sense a restaurant review by Patrick Matherly. On a Saturday morning at Bon's Cuisine, the line shifts and morphs as the door swings open and shut. There's no music playing, just the muffled whispers of customers and the scrape of steel spatulas against cast iron woks from the back of the restaurant. Above the counter, the restaurant menu lists Chinese dishes like gung pao chicken, sweet and sour chicken, fried wontons. Continue reading and you'll also see Vietnamese dishes such as chicken curry, chicken and broccoli in satay sauce, and the imperial roll. But the heart of the Bon's menu, one that draws regulars back on Wednesdays and Saturdays, isn't posted here. Maneuver toward the back of the restaurant, past the cash register and the tables of customers leaning over steamy plates, and you'll encounter a corkboard with traditional Vietnamese specials tacked to it. These specials, which are available just twice a week, include dishes like pho che, bún ga, chicken turnovers, and the popular vegetarian plate. Bon's Cuisine, commonly referred to as Bon's, was opened in 1988 by Chi Bon and her family. At first, the 9th Street restaurant primarily served Chinese dishes with a few Vietnamese options, such as chicken curry and the imperial roll, cha jo, that Chi and Chan, Chi's brother, believed would work with the American palate. Chi says, "We are from Vietnam and our ancestors are from China, so we are Chinese-Vietnamese." The first big wave of Vietnamese refugees settling in the U.S. came in 1975, followed by two more waves in the late 70s and late 80s. But in those early years, Chan recalls, it was still difficult to source Vietnamese ingredients such as fish sauce. Because restaurants, Vietnamese restaurants, were rare in Durham and unfamiliar to most Americans, the Ba family chose to focus on the cuisine that would be familiar to their clientele, Chinese food. John says, every Vietnamese restaurant we knew that opened would close within a year. That's why when we opened, we only did Vietnamese foods on Saturdays. Around the time that the family opened Ba's, Chan recounts, he would only see the same three businesses everywhere he went. A pizzeria, a Chinese restaurant, and a video rental store. The widespread popularity of Chinese food and lack of access to many Vietnamese ingredients made an opening a hybrid Chinese and Vietnamese restaurant the clear path forward. Chi chose to open the restaurant on 9th Street, which put them in good company along businesses like the Regulator Bookshop, 9th Street Bakery, and Wellspring. The Ban family found that these businesses catered to a crowd that was willing to try new things. 9th Street patrons naturally became the early adopters of Ban's Chinese and their Vietnamese specials. Early on, Chi and Chan picked up on the number of vegetarians that came into the restaurant. Chan recalls, we used to only have a stir fry, you know, just mixed vegetables, and people started asking for more. Chan took the feedback to heart and started experimenting with tofu. The vegetarian plate was born and added to the specials board. Nowadays, the customers that seek out the dish comment on how soft the interior of the tofu is and how light and crispy the crust is. Christina Chia, a regular at Ban's for 25 years, says, I grew up in Hong Kong. I have quite a refined palate for tofu, and I feel like that dish, the vegetarian plate, is something I've never had anywhere else. It's so specific to them, and it's so perfect. Even people that are not vegetarian that we know come in and get the vegetarian plate, explains Chan. They just like the tofu. This plate consists of triangle slabs of tofu, lightly fried and topped with a black bean sauce. Accompaniments include a mound of sticky rice sprinkled with sesame seeds and ground peanuts, and a smoky wok-seared broccoli or a vegetarian salad roll. Chan says, our friends will go to San Francisco and ask for a vegetarian plate, and there's no such thing. When they go to the heart of San Francisco, to all the Vietnamese Chinese places, and want to eat the black bean tofu, and there's no such thing. So, we are proud to say that this vegetarian plate is something we came up with. The Vietnamese population in the U.S. has grown steadily over the years from roughly 230,000 in 1980 to 2.2 million last year. North Carolina's growth has followed suit. Census data shows Asians are the fastest growing ethnic population in the state, with the Vietnamese community making up a significant portion of that population, and so has the availability of Vietnamese food. Several Vietnamese restaurants have opened in the last 30 years that serve familiar, delicious food to the community, such as Pho and Poke House on Irwin Road, and Taste Vietnamese Cuisine in Morrisville, and many local groceries like the expansive Lee Ming's Global Market now carry Vietnamese staples. Amid these changes, Ban's Vietnamese specials have stood the test of time. In response to the popularity of the specials, the restaurant eventually expanded that menu to Wednesdays, and regulars have factored these days into their schedules. Joe Schwartz, a local chef whose restaurant of Jewish Southern fare, Max Jr.'s, will open in the Brightleaf District this fall, says, if it's Wednesday or Saturday, you don't even have to say what that means. It means you're going to Ba's. Though the vegetarian plate is the most popular special, regulars have good things to say about each and every dish. Many regulars opt for the noodle soups, such as Pho Che or Hu Chu, which are especially recommended in the winter. Chiao recalls, they only had the beef noodle soup two or three times a year. I remember that on a rainy day like today, how perfect that is. Situated by Old West Durham, Trinity Park, and Duke's East Campus, Ba's has become a comfort food mecca for students and locals alike. The restaurant is cozy, with two or four top options, perfect for a small group or for dining alone with a book. Part of the restaurant's comfort derives from its customer service. Chee greets customers and works the register, bringing out food, utensils, and condiments in a calculated order. It's clear from the calmness of the crowd surrounding the counter during a lunch or dinner rush that customers put a great deal of trust in the Bond's experience. Chee and Chan have built a place where newcomers can taste something unique that will keep them coming back, and regulars can enjoy the wholesome comfort food they've become familiar with. Schwartz concludes this article by saying, "You see other chefs eating at Bond's on their off days. It's something that's presented humbly and tells a story of who they are and who Durham is." So to recap this by Patrick Matherly, Bond's Cuisine is at 750 9th Street in Durham, and their phone number, 919-286-5073. Well, I record this Indie Week broadcast each Thursday just around a little bit past noon, lunch hour, and I have about 2 hours shy of my regular lunchtime, and so I'm going to continue with some food articles, and they are, again, well, let's see. Lena Geller reports now on Black Restaurant Week. Queen Precious Jewel Zabriskie says, "A lot of times people pigeonhole black cuisine into being just cornbread, collard greens, or stuff that isn't healthy, per se. It's so much more than that." Zabriskie, who owns Indulge Catering, LLC, with her wife, Jacqueline J. White, in Franklin, and is one of 51 business owners participating in Black Restaurant Week, Carolinas. That's an initiative that aims to celebrate and boost traffic for local black-owned food and beverage purveyors and to combat misperceptions about what constitutes black cuisine. In the week-long event, participating businesses are promoted on the Black Restaurant Week website and social channels, and they receive marketing resources. Felaine Farrell helped spearhead the launch of that week, 2016, in Houston. Farrell says, "When we first started saying Black Restaurant Week, everyone assumed that we were just offering soul food everywhere. It leads to that conversation of how diverse the black culinary community really is." The initiative also aims to raise awareness about the many mainstream dishes that have roots in black culture. "Oxtails," Farrell says, "started in the heart of the South. Now we have a joke. Bring back down the price of oxtails because they become so popular. Shrimp and grits started in the Low Country area. Now they're on every menu in every state. Chicken and waffles started in Harlem. Now they're on every menu." Indulge Catering is hosting a pop-up at its commercial kitchen in Franklinton, with the go-to menu items including halal lamb burgers with tzatziki, barbecue jackfruit on pretzel buns, Italian chicken parm burgers, and beef Bull City burgers topped with pimento cheese and turkey bacon. The pop-up menu, like the dishes Indulge Catering offers at routine event gigs, is a showcase of the cuisines that Zabriskie and White ate while growing up in the Bronx and Durham, respectively. Some items also pay homage to Zabriskie's Muslim and Gullah Geechee backgrounds. Locally, participating businesses include the Chicken Hut, Royal Cheesecake, Bon Frite Food Truck, and the Blue Tea Spoon. Durham cold-pressed juice business Blend of Soul, which operates as an online store, is featuring an Aikai Soul Bowl as a Black Restaurant Week special. Kira Gardner, who owns Blend of Soul with her wife, Margot Newkirk, says black cuisine is distinguished by flavor depths that translate from generation of lived experiences. Gardner says, "We were able to take disparity and heartache and passion and love and just clump it all up in one pot, like some gumbo, and excel and really push past those barriers that we experience every day, waking up in the morning. That's what makes black-owned businesses stand out. That's what makes us unique and beautiful." Zabriskie agrees. I'm not classically trained, she says. These are all home-taught recipes. When I cook, I listen to what my ancestors say. In summer and winter months, when the business is sluggish, restaurant owners in more than 100 U.S. locales are solicited to participate in these promotional Restaurant Week schemes, which began in New York City back in the early 1990s. With a few exceptions, like Black Restaurant Week, the initiatives take the same formula. For a defined week, participating restaurants offer a two- or three-course prefix menu to customers at a set discounted rate. Some initiatives, like Asheville Restaurant Week, are staged by city staff. Many, though, like our own Triangle Restaurant Week, are hosted by third parties who offer to promote participating restaurants on their websites and social channels. Across the board, the Restaurant Weeks have been touted as a way for small businesses to generate additional revenue and for diners to discover new places to eat. But for many industry entrepreneurs, Restaurant Weeks pose barriers to entry. The prefix menu requirement doesn't mesh well with food trucks, kitchenless bars, or casual eateries with cafeteria-style or counter service. Food businesses that operate out of incubator kitchens like Indulge Catering, or that specialize in specific product like Blend of Soul, are wholly disqualified from participating. And when restaurant weeks are hosted by third parties, there's almost always a processing fee involved. Triangle Restaurant Week, which requires a $350 fee, does provide participants with a $250 gift card for wholesale supplier U.S. Foods. But for owners like Gardner, who sources produce from black farmers, or Zabriskie, who cooks with halal meat, that gift card may not be as compensatory as it appears. According to Farrell, Black Restaurant Week's 2016 launch in Houston was sparked by the noticeable lack of black representation in the city's conventional Restaurant Week. When Black Restaurant Week came on the scene with a more inclusive alternative, a 100% free promotional campaign for participating business with no requirement for participants to serve prefix meal specials, it was met with enthusiasm. Farrell says it was particularly important that the initiative be accessible to businesses who did not have brick-and-mortar locations. Quote, a lot of businesses in the black community are started out of passion as well as survival. The passion of, this is my grandmother's recipe, I want to sell it. And the survival of, especially now after COVID, you hear a lot of people say, I was laid off from my job and so I focused my attention on this personal venture, which is great. But a lot of the time, they may not be starting out with the space or the resources for marketing. In the Carolinas, this year's Black Restaurant Week runs from April 28th to May 7th. This is a couple days to go. Gardner believes the event is sowing the seeds for long-term change. Quote, it's so important to make sure that you're not only supporting these businesses during Black Restaurant Week, but that you're extending it beyond and saying, what else can I do? Really ask that question. What can I do to be better in my community? What can I do to align myself with these black-owned businesses? Food and drink-wise, there is another article by Lena Geller. This one, which I will not have time to read, I don't believe. It's about the Jewish Food Festival. Again, Jewish for Good. It's on West Cornwallis Road in Durham, Sunday, May the 7th. Sunday, the May the 7th, from 2 to 5 p.m., $5. And the website, Jewish for Good, that's one word, jewishforgood.org. And this is about this food festival in Durham. Family recipes celebrated and passed along one knish at a time. I will have to skip that, but it is available on IndieWeek.com. And now two shortish articles I hope to be able to read before I have to close. From Art, from the North Carolina Museum of Art, the Department of Humanity, writes Byron Woods. Stacy Kirby says art museums are actually about humans. We tend to get lost in museums when we think museums are about art. But the problem that the Durham performance artist finds with most museums is that people have been displaced in them. She says humans are not centered in museums. The object are, the art is. I think that does us all a disservice. It really disconnects us. Now, Kirby, whose work, The Bureau of Personal Belongings, won a $200,000 juried grand prize in 2016, is speaking with an insider's personal knowledge of the scene. In addition to creating a series of pop-up civic office installations over the last 16 years to document and validate the identities and experiences and civil rights of the marginalized, Kirby has done conservation work at a number of museums across the country, including 8 years with North Carolina Museum of Art. Her latest work, The Department of Humanity, debuts over 2 afternoons there this weekend in a series of 45-minute guided experiences. The work is based on her research and experiences with a broad range of artists, curators, archivists, managers, and patrons who have given her the chance to scrutinize the cultural underpinnings of what an art museum is. It's a particularly appropriate moment for such a work to commemorate its 75th anniversary. In 2022, the Museum of Art undertook a reimagining of itself as an institution, accompanied by the largest reinstallation of its permanent collection since the museum's West Building opened in 2010. Museum Director Valerie Hillings also got a grant from the Andrew Mellon Foundation to fund Kirby's work. That's a 2-year critical interrogation of the premises and practices underlying the museum's daily work. Kirby says, Valerie has experienced some of the more controversial works that I've done. I think it's pretty incredible she was willing to invite me in to sort of hold their feet to the fire. Starting in July of 2022, Kirby and the agents in her research and development office installation at the museum interviewed visitors, artists, and staff, including custodial workers, through conversations and an official survey form. It asked patrons questions like, who has the power here? Referencing the museum's most recent high-profile rebranding, the People's Collection, the form pointedly asked participants, who are the people? Are you included? It's long been a point of pride that a $1 million allocation by the state legislature in 1947 made North Carolina the first in the country to fund and start a state art museum. But its first acquisition, Mammy, a 1923 oil on canvas by Gary Melchers that was donated by one of the museum's chief first sponsors, clearly stands now as a document of racism. In the portrait, an elderly, bespectacled black woman holding a discomforted white, blue-eyed baby. According to Kirby, it hasn't been publicly exhibited since the 1960s. Establishing an art museum is largely a series of actions taken by people with power, privilege, and wealth. Though museum spaces are all but inevitably created to preserve and celebrate the culture and aesthetics of their founders, they also frequently encode their prejudices. Kirby says that an art museum is, quote, a series of agreements, some spoken, some unspoken, that are made with many different types of people, artists, staff, visitors, funders, donors, board members, and legislators, not to mention the people of a people's collection. But such institutions don't always follow through on agreements made with a number of partners, including their own staff and communities. In recent years, museums have been criticized for little or selective outreach, and problematic pay gaps and working conditions have resulted in an unprecedented rise in unionizing at major museums across the country, including the Whitney and Guggenheim in New York and the Art Institute of Chicago. Kirby designed her latest work to give patrons the chance to examine some of these agreements the NCMA and its partners have made with one another. In the process, she hopes to cultivate the museum patrons' sense of their status as active stakeholders. She says it was really interesting that most people did not check the box on the questionnaire identifying themselves as the museum's funders, even though their tax dollars go to it. I want to empower them to think they actually do fund this institution. There is some ownership over the space. After stops at self-styled social location and declarations offices, where patrons can reflect on their varying social identities and declare belongings they bring with them into the space, participants launch on a self-directed experience through the museum galleries. In this second part, guides lead patrons through backstage sections of the museum they don't usually get to see, including an underground tunnel that links its two main buildings. Kirby says being in the tunnel is part of transparency of process to give the public a little more insight on how things are physically moved and also the different environments that staff work within. Transparency is really challenging for museums because they're so used to being encouraged to keep things private. Indeed, only a fraction of the museum's collection of over 4,000 plus artworks is ever on display. Going behind and beneath the public galleries is also intended to counter what Kirby calls the feeling that museums need to be perfect as institutions, this performative front, like we don't make mistakes. Owning her own experiences as a museum worker in the Department of Humanity, Kirby concludes, I'm trying to encourage people to be accountable for being human. We do make mistakes. We just need to call that out, be accountable to it, and commit to do better. The written responses patrons can leave at the end of their experience may help the museum's stakeholders to do just that. And once again, this installation, so-called, is ending. I just gave it to you. I have to look at that again. I believe it goes until just this weekend. So we can look that up. Yep, it's Saturday and Sunday, May 6th to 7th. So you might want to drop in there. Well, here's the Office of Fluctuation Control and Ceiling Repair, Bureau of Condiments, Soluble, Insoluble, and Indigestible Fats and Glutinous Derivatives, Chamber Ensemble, performing our closing theme music, John Federson for Indie Week. I'll be back with you for the next issue, and hopefully we'll have some more of our hard-hitting news from our local reporters. So thanks very much for listening. The North Carolina Reading Service has brought you this program, and it's available after this broadcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. John Federson says, bye.